Good morning. I'm Charlie Sykes, and welcome to what is eventually going to be the Bulwark Podcast, and we're going to be launching it after the holidays. But Bill Kristol and I thought that, well, we have some things to talk about today. So here's a special pre-Christmas edition. You can sort of think of it as a sample. So, Bill, here we are.
Good to be here with you, Charlie, and I'm looking forward to when we pick up in the new year, doing this regularly.
Yeah, well, we figured it's the winter solstice. What else are we going to do?
It's the darkest day of the year. How appropriate is that?
It is. It's irresistible to even mention it. So let's just. This is where we're at. I was making notes about the week that Donald Trump, he caved on the wall, then he uncaved on the wall. The Flynn conspiracy theories collapsed. That Moscow Project letter surfaced. The stock market lost 1,000 points. We don't know what it's actually going to be doing today. His foundation was shut down and he was banned from philanthropy. The North Koreans said there's no nuclear deal. Stone indictments appear to be looming. It reports that the Mueller investigation is wrapping up. And whether it was to change the narrative or whatnot, he precipitously announces the withdrawal from Syria, which, of course, hands a massive win to Russia and Iran and rattles all of our allies. The Secretary of Defense, the first time in American history a Secretary of Defense has resigned over policy difference. And I'm not done yet here, see. You know, and he appears to be about to shut down the federal government. So we do have things to talk about today, but I want to start off with this. 1 week ago today, Bill Kristol, you were sitting about a block from where we are right now in the offices of the magazine that you founded, the Weekly Standard,
founded in 1995, so 23 years ago. Yeah.
And you were told that the magazine was being shut down. So it was 1 week ago today. So you want to talk about that?
It was unfortunate, I think. People took it well. We sort of expected it a little bit, though unfortunately our corporate overseers didn't choose to give us advance clarity on what exactly was happening. So people walked into a meeting on December 14th, not knowing much longer or if they would be employed and how much they could plan for in terms of, you know, salary and severance and so forth. But our people are resilient. People are getting jobs, applying, you know, look at being interviewed, trying to figure out next career paths. I think in some ways, I think they'll do fine, honestly. And the spirit of the Standard will live on, partly here at the Bulwark and partly elsewhere, as people fan out. And so I, you know, it was worth doing. As everything good comes to an end, but the Standard has come to an end.
Yeah, but the loss, actually, you and I were talking about this. It does feel particularly, you know, poignant today because you think about what would the Standard be saying at this particular moment. And, of course, we said that this was a pivotal moment or a turning point before. We'll get to that in a little while. But the Weekly Standard you walked in a week ago today to a summary execution of something you devoted a good portion of your life to. So, I mean, you have a much sunnier disposition than I do, but that had to have been, Bill, brutal.
I was expecting it a little, but yeah, it was, as I say, unfortunate. And I mean, the work exists. The people who found their first or second jobs there and who got on to do lots of important things, they exist. And whatever effect we had on the world, I think we've had and will continue to have. Actually, it's the material, you know, the articles, the arguments don't go away just because the magazine stops to exist. I did think, I've got to say though, yesterday, which was normally when we would close the print magazine, as you know. What a week it would have been to have Tom Joslin on the Syria withdrawal, which he's been warning about for a while and really detailing the implications of, to have Mike Warren on what the inside story at the White House of what was happening this crazy week, to have you on the Republican Party and how it was reacting, whether this would be a moment, whether Senate Republicans would do something. And I'm just obviously making this up there. You know, we didn't assign any pieces, so I don't know who would exactly have done what, but I think it would have been a particularly good week for the Weekly Standard. In the sense that I have several people emailed me this morning actually and said, gee, this would have been a great week to read you, Bill, and Steve Hayes, and Charlie, and Mike Warren, and John McCormick, and Tom Joslin, and many others on what's happening. So I think they still can read a lot of us or hear a lot of us, and here we are.
Yeah, we're not going away.
Here we are talking, so we're not going away. Trump, I think President Trump tweeted on Saturday, right? He said, may it rest in peace. And my main response to that was, we're not resting in peace. We're going on to do other things, and this little podcast here is one such thing.
Well, yeah, no, you want to look. We want to look forward, but go back to the Weekly Standard, because there's been a lot of conversation and a lot of things written about the Standard, and the way it ended, including folks like John Podoretz, who say, look, this was not the marketplace at work. This was murdered. And so I don't know what you're free to actually talk about, but in terms of there appear to be two different streams of narratives out there. That number one, it was the principled anti-Trump stance that annoyed your corporate overseers, your former corporate overseers. The other is that there was a lot of other dynamics at play with between the Weekly Standard editors and the owners. So give me your sense of why it happened and why the decision was made to kill the Standard as opposed to sell it or any other option.
Well, without getting into all the back and forth and details and so forth, yeah, I think both are correct. Our corporate overseers were unhappy with our anti-Trump, or let's just say Trump skeptical stance, and the fact that under Steve's leadership, and I'm very proud of this, we stuck to it in 2017, 2018, when an awful lot of people who had been very skeptical of Donald Trump decided, well, he's president and the Republicans are following him and a lot of the conservative media are following him, and so we're not going to stand astride this yelling stop, to quote Bill Buckley in a somewhat different context when he started National Review. So we did stand against the current, and I think that I know that was they were not happy to be owning the magazine that was standing against most conservatives and most Republicans. There were also internal corporate dynamics. Washington Examiner was sort of their favorite baby, and what effect of killing the Standard when they did, as opposed to selling it or letting us take it private, which we had plenty of backers for and plans to do, is that they get to fulfill the Weekly Standard subscriptions with the Washington Examiner. We'll see how our subscribers, like the new Examiner, and we'll see what happens with that. But I think there was an internal corporate dynamic at work, as well as the Trump dynamic. The two came together in an unfortunate way, and here we are.
Well, and this, of course, raises the question that we talk about all the time is, is there a market in the current Trumpian age for conservative, non-Trumpian media? And, the Trump folks, of course, would like to argue that we are irrelevant, that there is no legitimate conservative Trump voices, which, by the way, I think particularly as we're sitting here today, it feels more relevant and important than almost ever before.
That's the irony, right? No. The magazine will go away, I think, the week that maybe a lot of its fears and predictions and worries about President Trump begin to really become, not quite vindicated, but let's say, but become much more evidently reasonable and perhaps evidently true. Look, and our subscriptions have been drifting down, paid subscriptions. We'd raise the price, on the other hand, so the revenues were about even. And print magazine subscriptions are drifting down everywhere, obviously. Online, we had about doubled our unique readers, unique visitors to the website in the course of the Trump presidency. It was actually close to historic highs for the magazine. And really, this is not worth getting into in detail, but in terms of the quality of people coming as opposed to just clicking on as they'd seen something on Drudge, it was by far the best quality. People were actually coming to read articles and read the magazine and read the website, not simply one kind of good headline that gets a lot of people once and they never come back. So actually, the magazine was doing fine. These magazines don't make money. There's a lot of competition on the web. So, it remains a challenging business environment. But the business environment hadn't changed much. There was no reason to kill the Weekly Standard now that there hadn't been 5 years ago or 15 years ago if you were concerned about losing a couple of $1 million a year, honestly. And billionaires really aren't if they believe in something. And indeed, I think we could have done a lot to improve somewhat the deficit, but they had sort of decided about a year ago to not worry too much about that and to put all their resources behind the Washington Examiner. So anyway, there's no point crying over spilt milk, as they say. And I sort of wish we had the magazine this week, but we're doing our best here on this podcast to provide a little taste of what will come at the Bulwark in the future. And there'll be plenty of other ways in which I think the voice of the Weekly Standard won't die out.
And I also think that this notion that there are no that never Trump or Trump skeptical Republicans are irrelevant is sort of demonstrably false. You look at the midterm elections and you realize that it was, in fact, many Republicans who decided that they were disillusioned, that they weren't going to go along, that made a huge difference. And for the conservative movement, I mean, there is a moment where you step back and you go, he lost the popular vote in 2016 by 3 million votes. He lost the popular vote in the midterms by, what, 10 million votes. If we continue to be in our particular bubble, our alternative reality silo, this, you know, how is this going to work out for us? So you tweeted out something this morning from May of 2017, a piece that you said made your corporate overlords particularly uncomfortable. You called them overseers, I call them overlords. That Donald Trump's an embarrassment. It would be better for the country if he were president for at most one term. It would be desirable that his manner of governing go down in history as an aberration, that his form of conservatism be judged a detour from the broad path of a mostly praiseworthy movement, and that his type of republicanism be seen as a cul-de-sac from which the GOP finds an honorable exit.
Yeah, that was written in May 2017. The rest of the editorial actually is a defense of decent people going to work in the Trump administration, despite my disdain, our disdain for President Trump. And
this is going to be a good segue, isn't it?
Yeah, I do. Right. No, I think it explicitly mentions Jim Mattis as one such person. It was a defense against actually some, let's call them more strident never-Trumpers, who were saying no one decent should go to work in that administration. And I made the, I think, pretty commonsensical point that, look, we do care about the country, and if you can have responsible people in key places, either at the top or in the middle of the of agencies, that's a good thing. Doesn't mean, you know, you'd have to evaluate each job on its merits. And I think I say at the end of the editorial that if people feel they have to resign on principle, that's also perfectly appropriate. But for now, we're going to defend those people who are in there doing the right thing for the country. But we're not going to yield on the proposition that Trump is not likely to be a good president. Well, what a lot of what these people will do is limit the damage. That part of limiting the damage is limiting him to one term. That's why I've been so interested always in a Republican primary challenge to Donald Trump. And so I think that editorial stands up pretty well. But it did make the harshness, I guess it was harsh, of what I said about President Trump at the beginning, I think unnerved our corporate friends who thought this is not a time, this is supposed to be constructive. We're all working together. We're all on the same team. You know, whatever happened to team spirit and all that.
Okay, so now we have this moment. And for a lot of us, you know, we've been asking this question, you know, what would the breaking point be? What was the turning point? And I think it's been called so often, it's almost become a joke. It's become our version of Infrastructure Week. But the resignation of Jim Mattis, the way he resigned, that letter, is an extraordinary inflection point. I want you to talk about this, because for a lot of us, I think you'd looked at this administration and said, okay, as bad and shambolic as it is, there are still the grown-ups, there are still people like Jim Mattis who are going to be able to shield us from the worst possible consequences. And now he's gone. And you, I think you said that you haven't been... You're worried about this.
I am worried. I mean, John Heil, I was on Morning Joe this morning discussing it, and John Heilman actually made, I thought, a good point that, you know, in the past we've been very worried about, I mean, Trump has said things that would indicate a bad turn in American foreign policy away from American leadership towards a kind of America first retreat and so forth. He hadn't followed through on that much of that. He had done individual things that were very discomforting, but at the end of the day, you could tell yourself, you know, our alliance structure was the same as it had been.
And that was the argument, right? Don't pay attention to what he says, because that's irrelevant. It's what he does.
And his cabinet secretaries and the institutions in general are keeping him in check. The Syria decision, followed by the Mattis resignation, I think really makes you think, okay, now we're getting into sort of real consequences, not just rhetoric, which has itself bad consequences, but maybe more limited. I mean, the actual effect of pulling out of Syria will be very, very serious. We warned against it over the last couple of years. We warned against it under President Obama. We warned against it when he pulled out of Iraq in 2011, and that led to the creation and the rise of ISIS. So that's itself bad. But the Mattis resignation, I think just the importance of that is really fundamental, because I have been, well, I'll just give you an example or an anecdote. I ran into someone who knows Mattis pretty well, a retired general, is in touch with him, has been in touch with him fairly regularly. And I asked him earlier this week, with the Syria news was percolating that it might go, this decision might happen. I said, do you think Mattis will stay? Will he resign? And this fellow said to me, look, Mattis is staying until he's forced out. Mattis thinks...
Yeah, that's what I heard.
Yeah. Yeah, it's important for the country, he thinks, not out of ego, but out of just that's he happens to be in this job and he can do some good.
No, I talked to somebody who said they were talking to somebody close to him the night before his resignation.
Yeah.
He said he will absolutely not resign because he feels his mission is to protect the force.
And then, so the, what does it say that he resigned, as well as you said, the letter, the way he did? For me, it says not just that he lost a particular argument about Syria, though that was an important one, but that he also thinks that going forward, he would have been unable or very unlikely to be able to check Trump from doing other things in Afghanistan and elsewhere that he would regard as damaging the nation's well-being. So for me, it's a very big moment when someone who was bending over backwards to stay, to do his best, to not, he doesn't, Mattis is a very tough, you know, thick-skinned guy. He doesn't take the insults personally. He doesn't get emotional and resign because, you know, Trump was not nice to him at some meeting. I mean, Mattis is the furthest from that. Total professional Marine. And the fact that he felt, I just can't really do much good anymore, and in fact, I could do more good by stepping away and making clear what's at stake, as he did in his letter, that for me is a very big moment, bigger even than the firing of McMaster, which I think was a big and bad moment, the resignation of Gary Cohn, you know, a lot of the other people who've left, that also was worrisome. But for me, Mattis is a big exclamation point.
And this
and
is why
a big
people,
question yeah. mark about the future.
Well, and what are the policies going to be with Korea going ahead?
Right.
When Gary Cohn left, we launched the trade wars. What are the other consequences? And also, there's the pattern of this president who now feels that he doesn't need to listen to people, the way the decisions are made. Even if you could argue that maybe at the end of the day, you know, we ought to have a smaller footprint in the Middle East, the abruptness of it. This is the pattern that I think why you hear the word rattled, not just here, but all around the world, the allies. So here's the question, though, as you look at where we're sitting right now, stock market. I don't know what the stock market is even as we speak, but it, you know, awful, awful week. Prospects of an economic downturn, government shutdown, the Secretary of Defense, most universally respected member of his cabinet, resigns with a stinging repudiation of Trumpism. So does this actually make a difference? Does this move the needle in any way? And I know we've asked this before. Let me make the case for it that this might be different because the stock market and the economy, obviously, that has real-world consequences. This is not just some internal Washington game. Mattis, I think, raises anxiety about war and peace. I'm not sure that if you're Donald Trump and you support Donald Trump, it's because he's strong. And there's a perception of not only of weakness, but also that erratic nature, which is so much on display. Now, people, say on Fox News or on, you know, the Ann Coulters of the world may, you know, like that sort of, you know, erratic demagoguery, but I can't see it playing with the voters who are going to decide the 2020 presidential election.
Yeah, no, I think not. I think the combination of, you know, the election results, which, as you said earlier, just in a very simple, it was a big turnout, more like a presidential turnout. Republicans had won the House races, total popular vote by about a point in 2016. Trump had lost the popular vote by a little over 2 points. He ran behind the Republican House candidates. Pretty much the same Republican House candidates ran this year. There were some retirements, but pretty much mostly the same. And they lost by 8.5% or 9%. So that's a pretty big swing. And it's a little hard to see why any of those voters come back in 2020. So suddenly you're looking at a party that's heading towards minority status under Trump. Already precarious and going in the wrong direction. The economy, which has certainly been boosting him, looks shakier, and certainly the markets will be down for 2018, having been up for very much up for 2017. That's a pretty big change. Then you have an administration that at the end of 2017, think of it this way, if we were sitting here in December right before Christmas 2017, would have H.R. McMaster, would have John Kelly, would have Jim Mattis, would have Gary Cohn, and suddenly, they're all gone or going. The replacement would have Jeff Sessions, whatever you think of him, a serious person, at Attorney General who was protecting Rosenstein. And now we have Matt Whitaker, this acting Attorney General. I mean, it's a pretty big decline.
And we didn't even get to the Whitaker story before.
Right.
We find out that he was told that he should recuse himself, and he's not, which is another, you know, again, in Earth 2.0, that would be a stunning story.
Yeah, totally.
But there are so many other stunning stories, he doesn't even make our list.
I was going on Nicole Wallace's show yesterday. It was 4 o'clock. So we're going to discuss the shutdown, basically. Mm-hmm. That was the big story. Trump had signaled it was fine to have the continuing resolution without the wall money. Suddenly, the Republican senators all go out and vote for it. Suddenly, Trump changes course and leaves these guys exposed. And, you know, could Ryan get it through the House? And then suddenly, I think it was literally about 15 minutes before the show, the Whitaker story breaks that he had rejected the advice of the career ethics people. Not that he had to necessarily recuse himself, right, but that it would be advisable to do so. And he got sort of mysterious advice from some group of his that he convened on his own. So they kind of hurry that into the lineup, and they give us a little heads up on email. Hey, be ready to discuss this. Here's the article from the Post, I think it was. And then the Syria decision's out there. We discussed that at the end of the show. And I said at 4:57 p.m. or something, you know, I was literally the last thing I think said on the show was, I think Mattis will stay. I'm told by people that he very much disapproves of this decision, but thinks he can continue to contribute. And then 20 minutes after we're off the air, the story breaks that Mattis is resigning. So, I mean, it's a pretty amazing day yesterday, but it shows you how fast things are moving. But again, it shows, for me, that's very, December 2017, I had plenty of doubts, and more than doubts, but criticisms of Trump fundamentally going in the wrong direction. But that was more like that he's going to be going in the wrong direction. And for now, what would have said, markets up, unemployment very low, no real world consequences, not too many at least, of his inclinations on trade and America First and other things. Charlottesville was very bad, but that had happened, and, you know, it was sort of over, you might say. And now I think we're in a very different moment. And the election's a big part of that, too. And I've got to think that normal Republicans out in the country or in the Senate looking forward are thinking to themselves, what have we got ourselves into
here?
Well,
and that's the thing. You know, you and I have done so many of these shows where people say, you know, what is the breaking point for Republicans? When are Republicans going to push back? And I've gotten to the point of saying, okay, we've done this before. The answer is never. You know that. However, over the last 48 hours, you have seen people pushing back on the Syria policy, on other things. The statement by Mitch McConnell was, I think, one of the strongest statements I've seen criticizing the president. Even Marco Rubio, who has been contorting himself to accommodate the president, had rather strong words. So you are seeing, you know, some of those moments. We don't know how the shutdown is going to play out, but I imagine that didn't play well with Republicans in the Senate, who thought that they had an understanding, they thought they had a deal, and now they've been cut off at the knees. And do you see there's any prospect at all? The president is tweeting that they need to invoke the nuclear option, get rid of the Senate filibuster, which I personally think would be an absolute disaster for government, would be a disaster for conservatives and Republicans. Is there any prospect that would actually ever happen, that they would be bullied into essentially nuking themselves?
Yeah, I don't think they're going to do it now with the prospect of a Democratic House coming up.
Great.
And
yeah,
with some Republican defections, they will want to filibuster some things that the House passes, probably, right? They may not have 51 votes against everything. So, no, I don't think that's going to happen. But I do think the shutdown, I imagine, is going to end up not being a huge deal in terms of its real-world impacts. They'll work it out either today or tomorrow or maybe early next week, or maybe, worst case, we will have a two-week shutdown, which would be not pleasant for some, you know, some people who work for the federal government, that's for sure, and for certain parts of society that depend on those parts of the federal government. But we'll get beyond that like we always do with these shutdowns. But I do think the degree to which Senate Republicans who've managed to tell themselves in various complicated ways that we can sort of work with a guy and work around him and manage things, I think this was a blow in the last week. Then combined with Mattis, as you said at the very beginning, was such a but Mattis was a very big talking point, especially among the foreign policy types and the stock market. So suddenly the sort of upper middle class Republicans who care a lot about the stock market are looking at it and thinking, gee, this is not going in the right direction anymore. And the hawkish Republicans or the internationalist Republicans are looking at this and thinking, I thought we had this under control, and I'm not sure we do anymore. And the people who care about politics, about elections, are looking at studying the results a little more and don't quite see a path back from 2018 under in a Trumpy Republican Party. So I think things are coming together in a way that they haven't before.
So do you think, I tweeted out that the events of yesterday made a Republican primary challenge more plausible. I didn't say more likely to succeed, just more plausible.
Yes, totally. I mean, I got an email from someone in New Hampshire last night who previously had been very skeptical. I mean, didn't like Trump, so was wishing my colleagues and me well in terms of finding someone to run and saying, you know, she was willing to help and all that, but pretty skeptical. Now saying, you know, I really feel like today was a big day, and I've got to think people are going to start being much more open to a challenge. As you say, it's not that it's going to be uphill. It's going to be tough, but I think the dynamic has been changing. It really did begin changing with the election, maybe a little before that even. And I think a lot of the election results took a while to sink in because that first night it was a little misleading. Right. And then you put those together, as I say, with these subsequent developments. And it's not stopped. I mean, it's not as if, you know, getting out of Afghanistan is not going to embolden al-Qaeda as well. And it's not as if, you know, the market necessarily stabilizes where it is now. What if it goes down again the first 3 months mm-hmm. of 2019? And what if the real economy slows, which is certainly possible? And there's a Democratic House, investigations, leave aside even Mueller and impeachment. Right. But what if various rocks get turned over? I think there was a story even today, I haven't read it yet, about some deputy chief of staff in the White House who's sort of trying to stay on longer to change the retirement rules or something, and the Coast Guard to get himself a better pension. I mean, just sort of routine kind of. Yes.
How deep is the swamp going to be?
Yeah, no, the swamp creatures are all over the place, and we're going to see more and more of them.
Yeah,
right?
And that is another weakness, which is the whole drain the swamp. And have we ever seen an administration where you have more swamp creatures that so far hasn't seemed to register with folks? But also, one of the things that struck me about the pullout from Syria was the mission accomplished sort of feel to it. We've won the war. We know ISIS is done. And then, of course, everybody stands up and goes, okay, we've made real progress against ISIS, but it's not. And so what does happen if ISIS starts to reemerge over the next year and a half? This is the one thing that Donald Trump has done. You know, I never attribute, you know, genius to the man at all, but the way that he conflated immigration and terror and made that into one package, that is the heart of his message. And if, in fact, he cannot deliver the wall and ISIS begins to reemerge because he, you know, precipitously pulled out, that strikes me as a problem. Here's one other thing. This is Aaron Blake from The Washington Post, who, you know, talking about the Mattis resignation. The pattern here of the Trump presidency replacing these grown-ups with yes men. A Secretary of State who discounts intelligence community once led, a national security advisor who ditched hawkish beliefs for Trump, chief economic advisor who shed free tradism for Trump, a chief of staff letting Trump be Trump, now Mattis, and then, of course, you have the, you know, fake, phony Attorney General Matt Whitaker, who is just basically the water boy for the administration. So the argument that, well, okay, Trump himself, you know, maybe, you know, he's kind of a loose cannon, but look, when you vote for him, you're voting for, you know, this right. this good government. We're not getting that.
No, and I think on the ISIS point in particular, I mean, God knows none of us wants anything bad to happen here or elsewhere to us or to our allies or Americans abroad. But the degree to which, I mean, Obama got out of Iraq in 2011, President Obama got us out. A lot of us said, this is not going to be this is a bad idea. We didn't intervene in Syria in 2011, 2012. Senator McCain and others were pushing for some help to our friends there, the decent democratic rebels. We didn't do anything much or anything really. And they ended up getting, you know, crunched between the Assad regime and basically ISIS and al-Qaeda-related groups. But you didn't see the consequences of that in 2012 mm-hmm. when President Obama right. ran for re-election. And indeed, he had begun the drawdown in Afghanistan after surging there. And they attacked, you know, Paul Ryan, the vice presidential nominee, for correctly saying, we can't just get out of Afghanistan. And Biden said, well, you just want to stay there forever. And of course, Obama famously made fun of Romney for saying that Russia was a big threat. We're getting out here and the end of 2018 or announcing that we're getting out, and the Afghanistan drawdown looks like it's scheduled to happen by the end of 2019. There will be real world consequences of this, I think, and they will happen while in the Trump first term. A lot of them will go beyond that, incidentally, and they're going to be hard to fix no matter who the next president is. But So I do think this is just from a political point of view. I know one Republican senator said this to his colleagues at their lunch this week. Whatever the substance, and he's very appalled by what's happening substantively, he said the politics of this are really a problem here. We're going to be responsible for what happens. And maybe we'll get lucky and nothing much will happen in Syria and Iraq and nothing much will happen in Pakistan and Afghanistan and nothing much will happen elsewhere when people see this level of weakness. But this is very risky. And I do think the pure politics of this are another thing that Republicans in the Senate and around the country are going to be thinking about, and makes them even more nervous. And again, Mattis was such a talisman to be able to hold up. Say, you know what?
He was a talisman.
Jim Mattis is there. He's the Secretary of Defense. Nothing irresponsible is happening. He wouldn't let something irresponsible happen.
I told myself that. You know, don't go off the rails. You know, at least this guy is there.
And now we can go off the rails.
Apparently, you mentioned Paul Ryan, and I have a piece actually in the Washington Post.
Very good piece.
Because I couldn't.
People should read that. Yes.
Well, but the key word in it is heartbroken, because it's sort of like what he could have been. Compared to what he is now. And I write it as somebody that, you know, really, I still like Paul. I admire Paul. I think he was the intellectual leader of the conservative movement, not just the political leader. He's one of those people that comes along just so rarely. And to sort of watch him crushed under the treads of Trumpism was, for me, I don't want to use word, you know, tragedy is hard, but it is so disappointing. And of course, for the left, it's easy because they will say, well, he was always a bad guy. He never actually meant any of this stuff, and he's just simply been exposed. I don't think that's true. I think it was a choice, and he made these choices. And of course, now he's leaving, not only with the massive deficits, but the final action appears to be having caved into Trump on the wall, leading to a government shutdown. And it's, you know, if you measure the fate of the conservative movement, where what you and I thought the future was when he was named vice president, to where we are now. I mean, that's the moment I keep thinking of when I was sitting there thinking, Paul Ryan is wearing that jacket that's too big for him, but he's the vice presidential nominee. This is the future of conservatism. And here we are today.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good melancholy note to end on. But I mean, you and I and Steve Hayes were all promoters of Ryan as the VP pick. And I remember when it happened, I didn't know if Romney Ryan would win in 2012, but it seemed like this was a good generational handoff for the party. Party of ideas, party of responsibility in terms of governing, in terms of entitlements, an internationalist party, a party on issues like immigration that was moderate and open-minded, I think, tolerant, forward-looking, as you say, young, idea-based. And think of that. I mean, in the summer of 2012, Ryan's the VP nominee. He's the future of the party, whether or not they won. That's what we thought. Donald Trump had meanwhile spent 6 months making a fool of himself with the birther stuff, and had been, you know, we had all kind of ignored him mostly, and Romney had ignored him basically, had accepted his endorsement for 5 minutes in some press conference and tried to forget about him after that. And so, you know, Trump was showing up occasionally on Fox and Friends going on about birth certificates. If you had told me, and I think you or Steve, six years ago, that Trump would be the president and Ryan would be leaving politics, that is a very tragic, maybe is too much, but it's a very sad trajectory. I don't think it was inevitable. Maybe these things happen in life, though. But again, the task now is
6 years from now. What's going to happen to you and we can't imagine now?
The task,
right?
is partly to understand what happened, but also partly to shape what happened and what happens. And that's where I think we really are now. We have a chance to shape a future for the conservative movement and the Republican Party that isn't simply an acceptance of this really terrible decline from 2012 to 2018.
Well, just a quick note. This is kind of, as I mentioned earlier, this is kind of a sample of what is going to be the Bulwark podcast. We are not going to really launch it until after the first of the year, but we just could not leave today without commenting on it. So we're doing this, think of it as what the beta run of the podcast, but this will be the home of the podcast, and Bill and I are going to be working together and coming up with this, you know, finding a place for some of these voices that I think become more important and more relevant as time goes on.
And meanwhile, Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays.
And thank you for listening to the first sort of edition of the Bulwark podcast. We'll be back pretty soon, and we'll do this again.